Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today, World Radio, the online edition for April 2011. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Andiam System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Andiam members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andiams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address andiam@courage.org. Our website is www.andiam.org. Let's begin in Newsfront. George Trennis, call N2GA, named CQ Magazine Contesting Editor. George Trennis, N2GA of Long Island, New York, has been named Contesting Editor of CQ Amateur Radio Magazine, according to editor Rich Mawson, W2VU. Trennis succeeds John Doerr, K1AR, who stepped down after writing the magazine's contesting column for nearly 22 years. Trennis has 2 decades of contesting experience in a variety of station settings and has several top scores to his credit, both as a single operator and as part of a contesting team. He has operated extensively from the Caribbean as well as from his home station in New York and has been a referee at 3 World Radio Team Sport Championship competitions in 2000, 2006, and 2010. George is a member of the Yankee Clipper Contest Club and the New York-based Order of Boiled Owls Contest Club. He is also a former ARRL section manager and past chairman of the Ham Radio University, a day of amateur radio seminars and fellowship on Long Island. Professionally, Trennis is president of a software and management consulting firm, vice president of a school for professional motorcycle riders, and a freelance journalist. He is married to Diane Ortiz, K2DO, an accomplished contester herself, and a former columnist for CQ Contest magazine, which was published in the 1990s. CQ editor Rich Mawson said, "I am confident that George will uphold the high standards for this column established by K1AR and will bring to it his own perspective. I look forward to working with him over the coming years." "I am honored to have been asked to contribute to CQ Magazine," said Trennis. "The contesting column is always the first thing I read. I hope to be able to keep up the great standards and traditions that compel me and many others to look forward to each issue." George's first column appeared in the March 2011 issue of CQ. Now another news front piece, Vintage Radio Shack catalogs dating to 1939, now on the web. You're in luck if you've been craving a stroll down Radio Shack memory lane. You might want to check out the following website, http://bit.ly/gr0wtb. The site contains catalogs for the company that date all the way back to 1939, according to an item from Amateur Radio Newsline. Each one is animated in a way that the click of your mouse lets you turn the pages or zoom in to see that special part or item that evokes a memory of days gone by. There is a history of the company as well, along with the story of how Charles Tandy purchased Radio Shack Corporation in 1963 for $300,000 when it was on the verge of bankruptcy, and built it into a mega corporation that it is today. That was submitted by ARN and K3MSB. Radio amateurs asked to track NanoSail-D. When a nano satellite, NanoSail-D, ejected unexpectedly on January 17 from the Fast Affordable Scientific and Technology satellite, the agency called upon amateur radio operators to help track it. NASA asks radio amateurs to listen on 437.270 MHz for the signal and verify that NanoSail D was operating. NASA received almost 470 telemetry packets from 11 countries. The NanoSail D beacon sent an AX.25 packet every 10 seconds. The packet contained data about the spacecraft system's operation. If you'd like to hear a recording of the nanosatellite's beacon made by Hank Hemanen, call PA3GUO, you can visit the following website, http://bit.ly/FZ45K7. Here's an interesting little short report. The 2.4 gigahertz distance record is set across Tasman Sea. According to a published report, a distance record has been set between Steve Heyman, ZL1TPH, and Adrian Pollock, VK4OX, in the first Trans-Tasman Sea contact on 2.4 gigahertz, 1,439 miles on a band considered line of sight. ZL1TPH in Orwa, New Zealand, was running 80 to 100 watts to a 1-meter dish. VK4OX in Bald Knob, Queensland, Australia, was running about 20 watts to a 24 dBi grid-back antenna about 29 feet off the ground. We thank those stations and the ARN, Amateur Radio Newsline, for that bit of information. Here's a little bit for some of you DXers or SYLers. The following three international stations are being activated this month. From Ghana, Keys Leitner, PE1KL, and Lisa Leitner's PA2LS will be operational as 9G5LK near the village of Mpenyi, Ghana, from April 28 to May 6. Their activity will be on 80 through 10 meters using single sideband, PSK31, and RTTY. You can QSL for a confirmation of listening via PA2LS. Moving over to the Caribbean, Aruba, DED Logan, W1HEO, will be active from Aruba, Islands on the Air, SA036, as P4/W1HEO from April 3 through 16 from the P49V contest station. Logan, who is promotion and recruitment columnist for World Radio Online, says operation will be on 160 through 10 meters, CW, and single sideband, with emphasis on the higher HF, high frequency, and WARC bands. Although this is a semi-holiday outing, he said, major effort will be devoted to maximizing on-air operating time. Operation on IOTA frequencies will include 14.260, 14.040, 18.128, 18.098, 21.260, 21.040, 28.460, and 28.040 megahertz. A special color postcard QSL will be available, Logan said. QSL direct only to the W1HEO address on QRZ.com or via the Bureau. And from Uganda, Nick Henwood, G3RWF, will be active as 5X1NH from Fort Portal in western Uganda through April 14. He prefers to operate CW but plans to be on the digital modes as well, with some single sideband on all bands except 160 meters. QSL via his home call sign or electronically using Logbook of the World. We thank ARN and W1HEO for these updated reports on worldwide listening and talking through amateur radio. Well, it's time for the editor's log. The editor is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Try loading up the kids, but ground them first. Next time someone schools you on the immutable laws of antennas, Take note of what helicopter aviation pioneer Igor Sikorsky once said, quoting, "According to the laws of aerodynamics, the bumblebee can't fly either. But the bumblebee doesn't know anything about the laws of aerodynamics, so it goes ahead and flies anyway." Close quote. Oh, did Igor's choppers fly? What brought this to mind was a thread during the WRO live online chat session on Super Bowl Sunday. Richard Kuruth, K3ZEZ of Collingsdale, Pennsylvania, asked if anyone had ideas on what I can do for an HF antenna. I live in a townhouse. Sadly, the borough he lives in won't let me put anything out front. There are electric wires across the back of my house. Turns out ZEZ is retired on a limited income and can't buy anything expensive. He doesn't have an attic. I currently have a half-wave 20-meter center-fed dipole out on my front lawn about 18 feet high, not even as high as my house. My town fathers say I have to take it down. No eaves to run the wire. My house is only 16 by 35 feet, he said, lamenting that if I can only get someone to gain access to the roof. He works VHF and UHF through a mag mount mobile antenna on his room air conditioning unit. Does this sound familiar? Especially as condo and townhouse living grows into popularity? What to do? First, don't necessarily listen to the antenna gurus who may tell you it'll never work. Back in the mid-1960s, my friend Randy Fisher, WA1ECC, had just gotten a Swan 350 transceiver. Technically, we didn't have to wait until the next day to put up an antenna and get on the air. The impatience of teenagers, though, dictated otherwise. His new rig had been set up in a room with a four-poster bed. We circled several turns of hookup wire around the four posts, used the bed springs as ground, and proceeded to work up and down the East Coast from Massachusetts on 75-meter phone. Just goes to show, you never know. WRO chatters offered even more proof and a lot of suggestions for K3CEZ. Gene Brecht, WI7N of Banks, Oregon, said he loaded up the window screen in my dorm room when I was in college in 1967. It didn't work real well, but I did make a few QSOs. Try stringing wire around inside the condo and use a tuner against a counterpoise on the floor, suggested Mike Hare, WA6ARA, of Ridgecrest, California. I've used that in hotels with some success. I've been chatting with a guy on 60 meters in Tucson who uses a screwdriver antenna on a tripod in his backyard. When he isn't operating, he puts it away. Good signal, too. To which Ray LaJoy, KB1LRL from Fitchburg, Massachusetts, added, "You can always set up a screwdriver on your vehicle, then run coax into the shack. The townies can't fight a mobile setup." What's a screwdriver antenna? Well, you could figure it out if you tried hard enough looking on the internet, I guess. LRL said he'd seen an article where this guy modified a vertical and mounted it through PVC. As well, and put it on the side of his building. World Radio Online Looking West columnist Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, wrote from Saugus, California, that he's once loaded up wet spaghetti on 6 meters. Actually, it kept drying out. And Larry Levy, WA2INM, now a silent key, and I had to keep spraying it with a water hose. That was Bill Pasternak talking. It was something around the summer of 1960. We were always trying to bust ham radio myths. Scott Hernandez, KD5PCK, from Mendville, Louisiana, said after Katrina, I visited a friend who loaded up his FEMA trailer. Ron Erickson, K0IC of Essex, Iowa, said, a random wire, 67 feet minimum, will work if you have a counterpoise and or some ground returns. I knew of someone who loaded up his outside TV antenna and mast. It seemed to work okay on 80 meters. I think I saw an indoor dipole taped against a wall some time ago in an article, chimed in Angel Santana Diaz, WP3GW, of Trujillo Alta, Puerto Rico. But it depends on what band K3CEZ wants to operate. With a tongue-in-cheek, KD5PCK said he tried tuning up his kids, but as usual, they were of little help. You should try grounding them first, KB1LRL shot back. Might work better. Lots of luck. Here's a short schedule of the WRO Live Chats Online, our first midweek session this month of April. Want to join us on the web? Here's the latest on the WRO Live Online Chat schedule. Our first midweek session will be Wednesday, April 13 at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, zero time constant. Hope you can make it. To better accommodate our friends in the United Kingdom and other parts of Europe, the Sunday, May 1 chat will be at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. That's 1900 UTC. Radio amateurs everywhere are welcome. We're soliciting more feedback on best days and times, so we'll let you know how June and subsequent months look in an upcoming editor's log. Regardless of the day or start time, the sessions are always casual and friendly. And for those of you who have internet capabilities, you could go to www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com to sign up for an email reminder that a chat is coming up. You can see replays of all previous chats on the website as well. The editor's log was submitted by Richard Fisher, KI6SN, Kilo, India 6, Sierra November. Well, you know, folks, I think it's a good time to go right now with the Handy Hams. The title of this piece is An Audible Transmitter Output Monitor with a Stealth Antenna. We've been doing a lot of reading about that just a few moments ago on the report of the online commentaries. This month, we step aside for guest columnist Mike Keithley, KJ6CBW, a Handy Ham member living in Mountain View, California, who has developed an innovative audible RF output monitor that connects between his transmitter and coax feed line. He writes about it here, hoping to perfect a design with more testing and perhaps offer it commercially. KJ6CBW can be contacted at the following email, mlkeithley@comcast.net. The director of Courage Handy Hams, Patrick Tice, called WA0TDA, made that suggestion. I am a Handy Ham member, totally blind, and a user of cochlear implants. After passing my general and extra exams with the help of the Handy Ham lectures, I wanted to set up an HF station. I have a Kenwood TS440 SAT transceiver, but erecting an antenna poses a big problem. I live in a mobile home park where rules forbid antennas of any kind, except for small satellite dish units on the side of the house. I even tried discussing putting up a flagpole with management with no success. So, rather than just giving up, I figured if I could get a thin wire up, no one would notice unless they knew what to look for. I talked this over with Gary Gordon, K6KV, a Handy Ham volunteer who lives near me in the San Jose area. He proposed a 70-foot number 16 antenna wire, which would be about 20 feet up and strung across some sturdy trees. We'd use the metal frame of the mobile home as a ground plane. The feed point would be at the place where the radiating wire was secured nearest the metal of the mobile home. Well, we put it up, but its SWR was 701 at its intended resonant frequency of 3.6 megahertz. We measured a radiation resistance that was too low for the rig's built-in tuner to match. Gary had a cool antenna analyzer. That meant we couldn't get power into it from the Kenwood. We felt that the impedance was so low because the antenna ran too close to the metal roof of the house. After Gary and I discussed the matter, I decided to buy an outboard automatic antenna tuner that could match a much wider range of impedances than the Kenwood's internal tuner. I bought an SGC-234 auto tuner. This tuner works from 160 to 6 meters and matches the antenna to any frequency I want to use. The secret is to mount the auto tuner right at the antenna feed point rather than at the transmitter. It's waterproof, so it can be exposed to the weather. When the tuner senses RF from the transmitter, it automatically matches the antenna in about 5 seconds. It remembers its setting, so a subsequent match is made almost instantaneously when the frequency is close to the previous one. It requires DC power from the shack, but the power lines are bundled with the coax. One problem we had was determining when the auto tuner completed a match, or if I was even producing output. So we designed an audible RF output monitor that connects between my transmitter and the coax feed line. It has a built-in speaker that can produce a whistle whose pitch rises as the power level increases. It's especially amusing to listen to it warble while the remote tuner is tuning up. You say, just look at the power meter? But I can't. I call the new unit the Automatic Transmitter Output Monitor, ATOM. Because the wire is only 20 feet above the ground, this is not an ideal DX antenna. It is more like an NVIS, near vertical incident skywave system, on the lower frequency bands, and is good for contacts to 500 miles or so. It works quite well, and I find myself doing far more captivated listening than transmitting. But there have been numerous contacts on 80 and 40 meters. We will find out how well it does on 14 megahertz and above when the solar cycle improves. There is no RF in the shack and no RFI in the house. The wire has tarnished from exposure and is now very hard to see. And Gary says it's good for 10 years, unless the trees have their way or the kids around here don't cut it down. That really happened, but we had it back up in a jiffy. So if you live in a condo, apartment, or mobile home, and they say you can't put up an HF antenna, do what you must and don't let anyone know. You can reach the Courage Handy Ham System at Courage Center Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN 55422. You can reach the Courage Handy Hams at 1-866-426-3442. Or you can email hamradio, that's one word, hamradio at couragecenter, one word, .org. And the Courage website is www.handyham.org. Handyham, one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, www.handyham.org. Let's take a few moments to look at the future ham fests, or like amateur radio flea markets, and special events for April. Martinez, California, special event station K6M, Kilo 6 Mike. The Martinez Amateur Radio Club operating April 16, from 1600 Zulu to 2300 Zulu. It's operating from the John Muir House National Historic Site in celebration of the 173rd birthday of John Muir, father of the U.S. National Park System. Special event station K6M expects to be around 14.255 and 21.350 megahertz. Raleigh, North Carolina. Special event station N4C, November 4, Charlie. Operating from the 39th Annual Raleigh Ham Fest and ARRL North Carolina State Convention. That is April 3. The time given here is 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but I'm sure they probably mean Eastern Daylight Time now, on appropriate and approximate frequencies. 7.235 or 14.235 single sideband, and 7.055 and 14.055 on CW, Morse code. From Belton, Texas, Ham Expo, April 2nd. Bell County Expo Center, 301 West Loop 121, sponsored by the Temple Amateur Radio Club. All kinds of activities there, various frequencies also if you want to listen in. The State of Nebraska CUSO Party, NQP, 1700 UTC, April 24. In Venice, Florida, Special Event Station K4S, Kilo 4 Sierra. From the Venice Shark's Tooth Festival, Venice, Florida, Tamiami Amateur Radio Club. That's going to be 1300 Zulu to 2400 Zulu on April 8 through 10, various ham frequencies. Spring Grove, Pennsylvania, York Ham Fest, Saturday, April 9. It's sponsored by the York Ham Fest Foundation. The location is Porter's Community Fire Company. That's at 1199 Porter's Road, Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. And stretching a bit further into May, the ever-popular Dayton Hamvention, May 20th through 22nd at the Hara Arena. That's on Shiloh Springs Road in Dayton, Ohio. In conjunction with that, the DX Dinner, sponsored by the Southwest Ohio DX Association. It's in conjunction with the Hamvention. Dinner will be held on Friday, May 20th at the Dayton Marriott, 1414 South Patterson Boulevard, Dayton, Ohio. And one more listed for May, Waxahachie Amateur Radio Club will be sponsoring the 49th Annual Cadillac Swap, Saturday, May 7th, at the Cadillac Junior High School, 500 Chestnut Street in Cadillac, Michigan. We have another featured piece here. The author is Chris Merschrod, M-E-R-S-C-H-R-O-D. His call is KM2KM, Kilo Mike 2, Kilo Mike. It's titled, All Upgrading Took Was a Plan and a Bit of Extra Effort. At one point, when the advanced class still existed, I bought the study manual and thought that I could squeeze in the studies to upgrade my amateur radio license while away on an overseas assignment. For a lot of reasons, that didn't work out. It wasn't a new theme, though. I've been thinking about moving up in the amateur radio ranks for more than 27 years. Well, in the last year, just the excuse I needed arrived. I let my subscription to QST Magazine lapse, and the renewal offer included my choice of a book free. The only one on the list I did not have was, you guessed it, the Extra Class License Manual. It arrived about 6 weeks before the Tompkins-Cortland Amateur Radio Club would be offering VE exams. Fellow hams have been encouraging me to upgrade, showering me with the all-essential moral support. It was perfect timing, except for the two-week trip overseas we'd planned to visit our granddaughters. It was right in the steady period. On the other hand, it included transatlantic flights plus a couple of four-hour train rides. I was going to need a steady strategy. I really wanted to pass this exam. Socrates once said, "The only true wisdom is in knowing you know nothing." Well, I wasn't that bad off, but the first step was to note just where I stood when it came to knowing what needed to be known. A passing grade is 74%. That would mean answering correctly 37 of 50 questions that would be randomly drawn from the VE pool of 700-plus questions. There is an excellent QRZ.com internet site to test your basic knowledge and to accompany you as your studies progress. You could look it up on the WQRZ site. It offers 50-question practice exams with an option providing you the opportunity to continue checking answers until you have the correct one. That process includes a reminder, as well as a guide to the area or sub-elements that need study. Importantly, the questions are numbered according to the sub-element of the VE question pool. By jotting down that number, you can turn to any manual with the question pool numbers and read the material for a better understanding. I must confess, after so many years of ham activity that included antenna designs, kit building, and some actual design work, I was sure that I would have done better than 54% on the first practice exam. Not so. To be fair, though, that was before opening the manual and starting off on my journey with reading time galore. Most manuals are divided into sub-elements. I carefully read each question and responded while covering the text of the answers. The correct responses were checked off, but the incorrect answers were not checked off in the book. That way, I could review the explanatory material in order to grasp the concept and to remember the right answer. I spent a couple of hours at a time on each sub-element. Then, following the mantra, "Let it sink in or be lost," the next day I used another useful internet tool at a site called, now this is two words, Copacetic Flow, Copacetic, Flow. Now, for your listeners, it's not fair for me not to give you this website, but they're getting trickier and trickier, I notice, in this issue. It reads here, http://bit.ly/go(q)hq(t). It allows you to take a test of all the questions by sub-element. This is not the sample of the pool of questions. It is all of the questions. It is a match for the manual, and it tracks your progress. Again, it has the question reference number so you can jot them down to re-steady using the manual. Daily, I use the QRZ site to measure progress beyond the 54% baseline. The scores kept creeping up as I completed each subsection. So from the 50s, I marched through the 60s and 70s and 80s until the last few days before the exam, I reached the high 80s and low 90s. The QRZ.com site offers different samples of random questions. So I started with number 1, and before taking the VE exam, I'd completed 17 tests. I often thought some of the sub-elements were beyond me. "I have no business knowing this," I said. Those were the areas that needed more study. Indeed, there were interesting subjects such as phase angles and the use of polar coordinates. When that material does not make sense, there is always Google with more information. The trick is to understand, and then the answers will make sense. As with any athletic event or mental effort, the trick is to reach the peak of ability just before the exam. The day before and the day of the exam, I took one sample exam in the morning and another in the afternoon and touched up the few questions that had escaped me. I was ready to go. The examiners cannot tell you your score, but I gather I had missed very, very few. One of the most enjoyable advantages of upgrading to extra class has been access to the 3.6 to 3.8 megahertz segment of 75 meters. The SSB-DX window, the upper part of 3.7 megahertz, has been so exciting this winter. I'm working South Africa to the Netherlands. The elbow room from 3.6 megahertz on up has been a welcome relief from the congestion on the upper part of 75 meters. The same can be said for the 7.150 to 7.175 segment of 40 meters on the weekends. So in summary, the steps are here. Order the extra manual. While waiting for the manual, look over the QRZ and Copacetic Flow websites. Immediately use the QRZ sample exams to establish your baseline and see what you need to know. Make note of the sub-elements where your knowledge is weak. Study the manual, sub-elements by sub-element. Take the QRZ sample exam once a day to measure progress toward the goal. Wait a night and take the copacetic flow exam of the sub-element after each sub-element. Take note of the sub-element problem areas and study them again. Plan to leave a couple of days between covering the sub-elements and taking the VE exam in order to allow time to go back for a review of weak areas. A day or two before taking the VE exam, take the QRZ exam a few times to touch up your knowledge. At the VE exam, just relax and slowly pick off the questions one by one. If you have doubts about a question, use the scrap paper to note the number and come back when you've answered the rest. Then, read the exam again objectively. Hand it in, and we will see you on the DX segment. On a humorous note, my wife Stella, K-A-2-O-X-G, enjoyed shocking family and friends by announcing the latest news. I now have an extra husband. One neighbor, obviously warming to the idea, asked, "How do you manage it?" Remember, folks, that was tongue-in-cheek. Thanks a lot to Chris Mershrod, KM2KM, for all operating took was a plan and a bit of extra effort. The previous article talked quite a bit about gaining that extra class license, which is the top level of amateur radio accessibility to the available frequencies offered by the Federal Communications Commission to amateur radio or ham radio operators. With that goes hand in hand the contest corner. Every month throughout the year, there are contests listed for amateurs of all kinds at all levels of licensing so that they can continue to fill their list of stations or states or counties or countries that they need to gain some significant awards in the hobby of amateur radio. Here's some contests listed for the month of April. Beginning with the Missouri CUSO party, April 2nd and 3rd, that's 160 meters through 10 meters on CW, Morse code, and single sideband. The Quarter Century Wireless Association CUSO party, 1800 Zulu April 2 through 1759 Zulu April 3. It's going to be on all bands and modes except the WARC bands. It'll be 160 through 440 megahertz, CW and single sideband. The EARTTY contest, 80 meters through 10 meters RTTY, radio teletype. Multipliers for that would be DXCC, the Spanish provinces, W, VE, JA, VK call areas. The Georgia CUSO party, that's 1800 Zulu 9 April through 0359 Zulu the 10th April. The next contest listed here is the Japan International DX contest. It's 0700 Zulu April 9 through 1300 Zulu April 10. It's on 160 through 10 meters CW. Again, Morse code, not voice. It should certainly be interesting to listen to and to participate in that contest because of the devastation that was caused by the tremendous earthquake and the horrific tsunamis that ravaged that country in the past 2 weeks. The Holy Land DX contest is going to be 2100 Zulu 15 April through 2100 Zulu 16 April. It's going to be found between the 160 and 10 meter bands on single sideband CW and also Digi. Another one, the Ontario CUSO party from Ontario, Canada. 1800 Zulu 16 April through 0500 Zulu 17 April, plus 1200 through 1800 Zulu 17 April. The bands 160 through 2 meters. Moving along now, let's take a look at promotion and recruitment. Tapping into the power of print. It's by Devere D. Logan, W1HEO. Written communication provides an important advantage over verbal messages. Spoken words are easily misunderstood and can't be consulted later for clarification. This is why important documents are generally written on paper to assure clear understanding and provide an easily consulted future reference. Yes, the spoken word still has its uses and can be a powerful tool, but print, whether on paper or downloaded from the internet, provides many advantages. Promoting ham radio historically has been done by elmers or mentors through personal conversations or one-on-one demonstrations. But printed promotional materials allow us to circulate information about amateur radio to a much wider audience. Printed pieces are ideal for raising awareness of ham radio among target groups. Typical of these are local emergency management, police, fire, town officials, teachers, youth groups, service clubs, potential club members, and similar. Often a printed piece provides an initial introduction to our radio service that could lead to a later follow-up in-person visit or presentation. Let's consider the main functions and uses of printed promotional materials. First, they can provide a description of the amateur radio service, since the reader may have only a vague idea of what it is. The text can cover the licensing structure, valuable benefits, and fun of amateur radio, examples of how it is used, a bit of history, and so on. There are several sources of informational print literature, including CQ amateur radio magazines and others. The RRL and, of course, radio clubs have printed information also. Next, literature can describe the local ham radio scene, such as area emergency preparedness, radio clubs, and skyhorn nets. The main advantage of this is to provide a strong local emphasis and contact information that makes it easy for interested persons to connect with the radio ham community. Every radio club or specialized amateur radio group should have a backgrounder that describes details of the organization's purpose, operation, membership, activities, and officers. This standard boilerplate can be used in various ways, often attached to a news release or correspondence. Another valuable application of print is in announcing upcoming events, such as the American Radio Relay League ARRL Field Day, or public demonstrations of ham radio. News releases and flyers are among the most common forms. The Radio Club newsletter is one of the easiest means of communicating radio-related activities. Although generally considered to be an internal publication, it provides a regular channel for documenting club activities and accomplishments. Many club newsletters document public service and community events that would be of interest to groups outside the radio club. Adding local press and emergency management officials to the club newsletter mailing list is a good way to keep amateur radio in the forefront and in the public eye. Some of the most common uses of printed material include publicizing a field day site, public demonstrations of ham radio, listings of club activities such as licensing classes, contact information for reaching elmers, emergency drills, and ham fest. Newsletters are easily distributed by standard mail or the internet. Making yourself mailer will avoid having to stuff the newsletter into an envelope and keeps postage costs down. Creating flyers and other materials can be done using a computer program such as Microsoft Word or Publisher. We create documents and then transfer them to a disk, which we take to an office supply store for printing. Good luck with your print projects. We hope that they become a useful part of your promotional efforts. Devere D. Logan, W1HEO, is a veteran radio ham who writes a variety of newsletters and has developed a variety of promotional print items over the past 40 years. You can contact him at the following, lowercase, DEVERELOGAN, one word, Devere Logan, at gmail, gmail.com. As I move along in the recording of the World Radio Online edition for April of 2011, I come to the Rules and Regs column for John B. Johnson. John's a very faithful contributor. His call is W3BE. I don't usually read much about the rules because it's rather lengthy and perhaps a little on the tedious side. I say that respectfully to people that are not too familiar with ham radio. And of course, we have a time constraint as well. But I always want to feature the happy ham festers, the special persons who are recognized every month by John B. Johnson. In Virginia, our happy ham festers are Ben Badley, W4FQT of Oakton, Virginia, and Ray Johnson, K5RJ of Vienna, Virginia, who are all smiles during a visit to the Virginia Beach Ham Fest in late 2010. This month's winner for station appearance is amateur call G4UCJ, Buckingham, England, sending, receiving, and editing. Shane Gilbert, G4UCJ of Buckingham, England, has a wireless setup that does double duty, satisfying his passions both as a radio amateur and a shortwave listener, a niche in a hobby that has crept into his professional life as well. UCJ easily found the harmonic convergence of transmitting and receiving, frills coming from both, and his beautiful operating position serves as mission control. Sean's radio station at home is pictured in the photograph on this page. The listening and transmitting position of Sean Gilbert, G6UCJ of Buckingham, England, is both neat and functional. Now, regarding the ham bands, as a radio amateur, he says, I am an advocate of using low power, or certainly the lowest possible power, to maintain a QSO contact. I have worked more than 170 countries with 3 watts or less, and simple, often indoor antennas. Plus, I have 49 states worked on QRP. I need Hawaii, and will be trying for that when the higher bands are in better shape over the next few years. He goes on to say, my first ham radio contact was with someone I had heard on 2 meters regularly, and unusually, he was also in a TV show at the same time. The gentleman was a King Gardener and was presenting a primetime program called Over the Garden Wall. Harry Smith was his name. But his call sign eludes me. It was G3 something or other. About a year later, I changed my call sign when I upgraded to an HF license, back when Morse code was a prerequisite. I was absolutely determined to get a G4 call sign before they ran out, so every night I would practice like mad after doing my homework. I was a very nervous 15-year-old schoolboy at the time, but somehow I passed, and Morse has stuck with me ever since. In fact, I became an instructor at the world-famous Bletchley Park, home of the English Codebreakers, and Station X, and then after a while was asked to be a Morse examiner. One other thing that happened at Bletchley Park was that I was asked to be the manager of the club ham radio station during the Millennium celebrations, and I set up links with Camp X in Canada, which was the equivalent of our own Station X, and oversaw the mayors of the two towns exchange greeting messages. When I am in a ham mode, my main interest these days is digi modes such as PSK, JT65, MFSK, WSPR, and the others. The way software has developed over the past couple of years means it is so easy to get involved and have fun. Pretty much any available computer or laptop will do the job. My laptop has an external USB sound card, which costs only a few pounds. It works a treat. The downside is that if I want to run software-defined radio in the future, I am limited by hardware, as most SDRs require a fast 3 GHz or better, dual core, and lots of storage, plus a very good sound card. I worked out that to get a good SDR system, I would have to spend roughly the same amount on both radio and PC hardware. So what looks like a cheaper alternative to a standard HF receiver actually turns out to be about the same, or even more. Let's take a look now, folks, at V E exams. I was a volunteer examiner exams in amateur radio. As a service to our readers, World Radio Online presents a feature listing of those VE exams, times, and locations which are sent to us. Please remember that our deadline for publication is 2 months in advance. For example, if your group is scheduling an exam for December, please have the information to us by October 1st. World Radio Online, VE Exams, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. Lists the location, that's the city and state, any information examinees should have, like advanced registration or whatever, and the name of the person to contact for further information. Examinees should bring their original license, along with a photocopy, two forms of identification, at least one should be a photo, and the required fees. Our next piece keys onto the Military Auxiliary Radio System known as MARS. It's headed The Final Report Card, Disaster Preparedness, a Commentary by Bill Sexton, N1IN, / AAM1RD, / AAR1FP. A polite if dubious blogger aired his skepticism recently on the Internet EHAM forum. Quotation, "What does Mars do, realistically?" he asked. He wondered if the military auxiliary radio system is one of those places, quoting, where they always prepare but seldom deploy, close quote. Good question. Good timing, too. After 20 years in Army Mars, I'm coming up with questions, too. For instance, how long will the welcome last for us plain vanilla volunteers in the increasingly officialized, stratified, and alphabetized orbit of emergency response? With all the proliferation of all the acronyms relative to emergency preparedness, etc., maybe there won't be space for a mere single resource. That's what I guess my Mars station would be considered in the Federal Emergency Management Agency's arcane terminology. So, let's do talk about the issue raised by a concerned EHAM who signed himself Acme News on the EHAM Mars Forum in January. His queries first. Mine can wait. Like volunteer firefighters, Mars members do indeed drill over and over for events they hope won't ever need their services, and thank goodness, usually don't. In that sense, it's true, we seldom deploy. We're not first responders in the technical sense. The Mars mission is backup, somewhat comparable to the second alarm fire companies held ready when a blaze threatens to get out of hand. You still have to be fit and know the job. The things we do. Did I detect an unspoken if anything? Actually, Mars members perform 1,000 tasks in 1,000 places. Mostly quite unspectacular, like repairing a repeater or helping an Army Reserve outfit set up radios for a summer exercise. One of the barely visible yet essential jobs is furnishing net controls and relay operators for the HF, high-frequency network, run by the Department of Homeland Security. It links government offices across the country whenever needed, emergency or not. Another such elite group with low profile operates the Army Mars WinLink system for email over HF. Also, there's the pioneering air-to-ground phone patch operation of the Air Force Mars. Those ongoing services rely on members of all three Mars branches, Army, Air Force, and Navy Marine Corps. Additionally, Navy Marine Corps Mars has enhanced and maintained the Mars Automatic Link Establishment, ALE, service. It, too, is assisted by members from the other branches. Now, here's one more upbeat example for Mr. Acme News, and this one may be new news to many in Mars. The Defense Department's National Guard Bureau, NGB, to which the Air Force and Army National Guard report, is close to completing its fix for the Como confusion exposed during Hurricane Katrina. This is a nationwide matrix of Joint Incident Site Communications Capability units, one at least in each state ready like a fire crew, for dispatch to any emergency. The Joint Incident Site Communications Capability Unit, which was described in the October 2010 World Trade Online Mars column, is a trailer-borne, air-transportable communication center, a giant router, actually, capable of plug-and-play switching for multiple inputs of every conceivable mode from CW to SATCOM, that's satellite communications. Now, Mars is providing HF connectivity. To Mars' ability to provide long-range voice and commercial email connectivity over high-frequency radio, that's WinLink, is an important communications capability for the NGB and a valuable asset during domestic operations, according to a letter from Army Brigadier General David L. Harris, the NGB's Director of Domestic Operations and Force Development. The most recent Mars addition to the NGB Joint Incident Site Communications Capability Program of Mars will be very beneficial. Now for my observations, admittedly based on familiarity with only one of the three Mars branches, although I've tried to keep abreast of the others. To reiterate, these are one member's personal opinions and do not reflect official policy or anything else. The job description. Boiled down a bit, the current Defense Department instruction 4650.02 announces four assignments for Mars. Note the order in which they're listed in this post-Katrina chart because the priority is significant. A. Organized volunteer radio operators enrolled in Mars will provide contingency radio communication support to U.S. government operations. B. Department of Defense components come first on the list of customers to be served. C. Civil authorities at all levels come next. And D. Mars will handle personal messages for our forces in remote and isolated areas in contingencies or whenever appropriate. This sounds reasonable enough on paper, but let's examine with care. What is contingency radio communications support? Does it mean working from the home station or joining an EOC, Emergency Operations Center staff, managing a regional HF net, or shadowing the incident commander in a disaster zone? Is it refueling a portable generator or constructing a communication center? And what is meant by a contingency? Merriam-Webster's answer isn't very helpful. Quoting, an event that may but is not certain to occur, close quote. The DoD's Dictionary of Military and Associated Terms, the 2010 edition, only gives us a situation that is in need of military response. Basic doctrine like the DODI should reflect painstaking analysis leading to prioritization of options based on what's achievable and what isn't. It should provide the foundation of fact and principle on which future command decisions must be based. For me, the clearest conclusion from reading DODI for paragraph policy statement is that it wasn't adequately staffed, for example, promulgated only after careful research and thorough consultation. What's most painfully missing are the rules of engagement. Without these, region and state directors can't begin to manage developing emergencies in real time, much less draft sensible response plans in advance. Like troop commanders in uniform, Mars leaders in the field need to understand the parameters of support and have in hand specific guidance on what constitutes contingencies. Those elements are the essential same page on which everybody is supposed to be. In a sort of serious incident where Mars services would be most needed, a presidential directive or operations order from Mars headquarters might never get through in time. Some members of Army Mars, the oldest and biggest of the three branches, may be struck by an oddity in the 4650.02 policy statement. It ranks military support ahead of agency support, but practice has been the reverse, an arguable consequence of vague and indecisive doctrine. as headquarters focus has lately evolved, even though we're called the Army Military Auxiliary Radio System. Growth has spurred it only in the area of civil support, building alliances with state and local emergency management agencies. It's as if there's neither time nor need for expanding military connections. Just call us the Auxiliary Radio Service, etc. There are hundreds of communities where National Guard or Army Reserve units are locally based, but for whatever reason, have no contact with Mars operators living nearby. Somewhere along two chains of command, the Department of Defense mandate for interoperability has been lost. Ladies and gentlemen, the article continues at some great length with interesting observation by the writer. However, it's time for me to say 73. Here on the Courage Handy Ham Systems reading of World Radio Online for April 2011. This recording has been a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handyham is one word spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M at courage, C-O-U-R-A-G-E, .org. handyham@courage.org. Our website, a very fine one indeed, is http://www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. My amateur call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is in southeastern Massachusetts near good old Cape Cod. I hope you're beginning to have a good spring season, especially with the snow still coming down the first and second day of spring here in eastern Massachusetts. I hope your weather is better. So till we talk again, thanks again for listening. N1BLF 73.